Hello everyone and welcome to this new episode of the London Circle. Today I'll be speaking with one of the captains of the ship Hanwala, which is trying to make its way down from the north of England, down all the way to London and then back up to North Europe. And its objective is to break the siege on Gaza. I'll be talking with Tom Adam Turnbull. We'll be discussing everything from the point of this gesture, from the wave of student movements around the world and its impact on the narrative, on Palestine, and on freedom and human liberation. Enjoy. The whole project about breaking the siege on Gaza started a long time ago, if I'm correct, around 2007. The siege began in around 2006. And funnily enough, and maybe a few people know that it came hot on the heels of the first and till now last Palestinian elections, which were at the time lauded as being one of the freest, fairest that had occurred in the region.
They had the Jimmy Carter stamp of approval. Yes.
And it, in a sense, incensed many Zionists because they wanted to hang on to the claim that Israel was the only democracy in the Middle East. And then, rather than the democratic world, the democratic West, rewarding the Palestinians for their democratic tendencies, they chose to punish them for the choices they made. And therefore, the siege was imposed. And for 17 years now, and believe it or not, 17 years, a blockade on an entire nation of 2 million people was imposed, whereby no one can reach that by air, by sea, and by land extremely difficultly. So this project about breaking the siege on Gaza, has it ever happened? Have we ever broken the siege?
It has happened. And if I'm correct, I hope I'm correct, somebody will correct me. 2007, the first attempt to break the siege of Gaza was by a group of dissident Israelis who left, I think, from perhaps Ashdod or Ashkelon, I'm not sure which, in a dumpy catamaran and managed to make their way down the coast. And I believe they actually touched the beach. I'm forgetting now, but there were two others that actually got close enough to get near the beach. And I think they probably spent at least a little time in front of the IDF and possibly in court as well.
Was it? But this wasn't part of the Freedom Flotilla. This wasn't part of the global break the siege, was it? It was Israelis who felt that siege was inhumane.
That's correct.
And wanted to do something to sort of symbolically even break that siege.
Yes, and it inspired, that symbolism did inspire the following attempts. The major one of which you know was the Mavi Marmara in 2010.
So it's quite, in a way, an inspiring story, because every single time one of these ventures is begun, and we start hearing about people enlisting to be on those boats, we then come face to face with the immense difficulties, sometimes bureaucracy, sometimes political decisions, sometimes, whatever. It is the impediments that are set so that basically the ships can't sail from a port, can't carry a particular flag, can't get a license or a permit, are in international waters and therefore are threatened to be attacked. So all this happens every single time.
It does.
It begs the question, what's the point?
Well, that is the question. And I can confess that after all three of these that I've been involved in, which were by that measure failures, I ask myself, do we keep doing this? And the answer after a week or two of sleeping it off is always yes. Yes, we do keep doing it. Even though, and I'll point out something much more disappointing for me over the period of time, that barrier of political pressure, when I first became involved in this with my wife, Karen DeVito, in 2010, that barrier was much, much closer to Israel. That is the political influence that prevented us And now that has moved farther and farther west, so that even when we talk to the Greeks, for example, or even the Spanish, or even the Italians, there is political pressure against us even there. So Israel has actually increased its political pressure, along with the United States, obviously.
What's the usual excuse? I mean, for instance, with the Greeks, I mean, what's their excuse?
It varies, and they always find a little something. You know, there are a lot of regulations in maritime law about how you conduct your voyage, etc., which are safety rules, basically. But oil spills, for example, there'd be a little bit of oil spilt by somebody, we're not sure who, and suddenly we're in there for another couple of days with an oil inspection on a giant ship, and it takes forever, and sorry, it'll have to happen next week, and no, you can't leave until then. And or it's you have 12 people aboard, that's legal for a non-commercial vessel, that's okay. But one of them will have to be a doctor. Now, that's a safety issue. And yes, we recognize that, and we've done that many times, but it's always that kind of thing. You know, the port in Greece was almost a, can I call this almost a cartoonish cop chase, you know, and I can tell a long story about that. But essentially, we were prohibited from leaving the port in Greece by the Coast Guard for basically no reason at all. We did attempt to leave, and it was a lot of fun. If we have more time, I'll tell you that story.
Tell me what happened.
Well, and so here's the danger about my telling this story about getting to gas. Yeah. So this is a general comment and a general caution. I can tell sea stories, sea yarns forever. They're always fun. They're always exciting. They're always adventurous. And I enjoy telling them. But I always face the fact that this is always about us trying to get there. It's very seldom a conversation about Palestinians waiting on the beach to see us. And that's the important part. It's those little kids. And we know some of them. They've grown up now. But they would go down to the beach because they'd heard the boats coming, and they'd look out in the sea. And I want to tell stories about them, but I can't because I haven't been there. I haven't been able to get to that beach and turn around and look back. So sea stories, fine. I can tell you dozens.
You've never been to Gaza?
I've been within 42 nautical miles. I've seen where it is. I've seen that shoreline. Can I tell you that sea story?
Yeah, of course.
Approaching in 2018, I was with the Swedish committee. I skippered the big old sailboat that got caught. We were caught, I think it was roughly 42 nautical miles out, and then we were towed into Ashdod, the usual thing. I can tell a prison story too, but that's neither here nor there. I looked at that shoreline, and as a mariner, I've approached shorelines in many places in the dark, and you always see what's called a loom over the city, the reflection of the light from the city and the energy and the activity. And to the left of my field of view, of course, was the loom of Ashkelon, Ashdod, and it looked like a normal place, people doing what people do and driving buses through the night. And I looked to the left, and it was velvety black, absolutely black, nothing there. And I had never seen a shoreline that was absolutely black. There was nothing to see. And I knew, of course, that there were more than 2 million people with no electricity, no light to shine, not even headlights on their cars. Their batteries would be down. And I thought, they're right there, and I can't see them. They're in the dark.
And tell me about that prison, inside prison story.
The cucumbers that they grow in Israel, or perhaps they grow them in the West Bank, I don't know. Maybe they're a boycott product, and maybe I shouldn't have, but they grow these lovely little cucumbers. And in prison, you know, anything is amusing. Any bit of food is amusing. So I remember the cucumbers. I also remember the slamming and yelling, and the fact that nothing they said was to us was ever quite true. It could be anything from "Are we having bean soup?" Yes, to "Are we getting out tomorrow?" To no, and it was never the fact. That's prison. It was not especially awful, and again, compared to the people who were in the larger prison next door, the really tough prison, the long-term prison, we could hear them. Compared to that, it was fine.
How long were you in prison?
It was only 4 days.
With how many others?
Well, in my case, they separated the men from the women. So we were I guess, 10 men, 8 men and 4 women. The women were in another hall, and we could call to them and tell jokes in Swedish and sing protest songs. I was with 2 fellows, a Frenchman and a Swede, who knew every protest song that socialists have ever sung, and they taught them all to me. And every time they did it, the prison guards would come to the door and slam it open and tell us to shut up. And they'd yell at me. They'd say, "Captain, Captain, come here." And I'd say, "No, you stole my ship. What the hell with you?"
When did all of this start for you? When did you become interested in... Because as far as I understand, your wife is Jewish.
No, my first wife is Jewish. I had two. My first wife is Jewish, and family Hungarian, survivors of that part of the Holocaust, as well as the Soviet invasion, etc.
But you're not Jewish yourself?
No, I'm not. And my second wife's family is mainly Italian, but, you know, from the north. And so we're not really sure. And who cares? You know, DNA tests are nonsense still. So I first encountered this when my parents took me to a congregation, a religious congregation in Toronto called the Unitarian Congregation. It's a very American, Northeast American thing, a Protestant movement, very liberal, very humanist. And many of the members of that congregation were Jews recently arrived from Europe to Toronto, integrating and attempting not to be Orthodox, because many of them were dissidents, they were Bundists, they were more political and what you would call ethnically Jewish than religiously, etc. So this topic of Israel, Zionism, pro and con, was circling around my head since I was 8 or 9 years old.
Hmm. And... when in all of this, when did the case for Palestine, when did it first start to be mentioned? What got you into this?
It happened in a very unusual way. It was 1967. I was a 17-year-old, typical, you know, interested in jet airplanes and warfare and who wins and who doesn't win and all that nonsense. And so it was the summertime. We were raving around, me and my friends and some Jewish friends, and we went to some place where there was a Yiddish-speaking uncle. At home during the afternoon, elderly man, and he actually took me by the sleeve, and I can still feel that, and took me over to a corner, and he shook his finger at me, and he said, "This is not good. This is not good for anybody." And I wish I could say it the way he said it. And I thought, isn't that peculiar? Isn't that strange? Why would he not be happy that Israel had defended itself against nasty Egypt and Nasser and the Soviets and all of that stuff? So I went to the library and I said, "So where are the books about Israel?" And that's been my part of my reading ever since.
And during that time, I take it that you've met with Palestinians, people who came to Canada to study or as migrants or as visitors or as such. You were exposed to writings of Palestinian academics and thinkers and the like.
In fact, not until quite late in my life. Mm. In fact, I had the experience many years ago in a business conversation, meeting a fellow called Khawaja. And he didn't mention being Palestinian. I didn't ask. I figured he was from somewhere else. Everybody in Toronto is. Mm. And it occurred to me later that he was probably Palestinian. And I wish I had asked, but I didn't. So I didn't get introduced to the Palestinian side of the literature. I guess until 2002, when my wife, Karen, went back to school to get her master's degree and had the good fortune of being told to do some reading about this. And she brought it home and said, look at this. And I'd always known about the conflict. I'd always been sympathetic. I'd argued with my Jewish father-in-law early on while he was still alive. And, so it was always there. I just hadn't done the work. Mm. And so in 2002 or so, I began doing the work of reading. And now, of course, you know, we have a library like everybody else in this activist business.
It seems to be fairly straightforward. Someone who is from a particular context, who comes in touch with people from a different context, who alerts him or her to, you know, to do a little bit more work and research and be a little bit more diligent about the facts that they're fed through the media and the such. They go on this this journey trying to discover, maybe having some arguments based on what is generally a human set of values. And then you come into contact with people who have a direct, you know, sort of know-how, a first-hand experience
yes.
with what's happening, and they start telling you about their own stories.
They do.
So in a way, it seems to be fairly straightforward. It seems to be fairly direct. What's the problem with more and more people not knowing about what you know now?
Well, you mentioned the, I'll call it duplicity of the media. Up until fairly recently, they're beginning to get it. They're beginning to admit they know it. That's that problem. There's also the problem that Palestinians who have managed to emigrate and immigrate to places like Canada and the States, at first, in the first generation, are typically more concerned with integrating and fitting in, just as my Hungarian family was initially. They don't necessarily proclaim themselves. I think perhaps it's the children who they bring with them who have the confidence to say, look, we are Palestinian. This is important. And yes, you should know about this. And they begin to speak about it. And obviously there are exceptions. You know, one of the first people I met who was outwardly Palestinian, a fellow in Vancouver called Hannah Kawas, to whom I owe a great deal, had a radio program. And I was driving home one night looking for a channel, and I heard this Palestinian fellow talking about a book that I wanted to read. And I thought, this is amazing. It's on the radio. How can this be? It was a shock. So Palestinians, at least in our society in Canada and the States, have been somewhat hidden. In the last 5-6 years, it's all changed, and I'm so glad it has.
And the change that we're seeing is remarkable. I mean, I can speak for the UK.
Yeah.
And only a couple of days ago, I was visiting one of the student encampments, and the level of awareness is stark, is quite gripping.
Yes.
And the kind of interactions and queries and questions and suggestions and ideas put forward. I mean, I'm younger than yourself, but I still remember quite well how hard it was having discussions with people over Palestine, Israel, and I remember the word Palestine was at a stage something that needed explanation. Because people would say, well, what is Palestine? What are you talking about? I mean, there is no such thing as Palestine. The mere contention of the legitimacy of the Israeli claim over Palestinian lands was something that people would find absolutely absurd. It's like talking about a flat surfaced earth, for instance, or something.
Perfect analogy. And you're in the UK, the UK that sent the black and tans from Ireland to Palestine. A whole generation of people in the military knew they were in Palestine. There was no question about it.
And still, having that kind of discussion was so difficult. But now, I mean, that kind of, I don't know, I mean, is it because of what's been happening over the course of the past 8 months in Gaza? Is it because communication and the kind of revolution and advancement in people getting their news from different sources other than CNN and BBC? Or is it something else? Is it that they're a younger generation grappling with their own identities? Is that it?
It's all of that. And, you know, as a technologist, my background is computers, I like to think that social media has changed all this, but it's not just social media. It's that we have lost confidence. Where you mentioned the flat earth phenomenon, and I'd like to refer to the late 1500s in Europe when people began to tell other people that, you know, in fact the earth was not the center of the universe. We've looked, it's kind of over on the edge. And not just the church, which we like to blame, not just the Catholic Church, which we love to blame, we old atheists, but also the political institutions and the academic institutions. knew that this was true. They got to the point where they knew it was true, but it was one of those truths that if you admitted it, suddenly the whole thing would flip over.
Absolutely.
And the whole thing is flipping over now. Now, how quickly it flips over, I don't know, but it's listing, to use a nautical term. It's going to take water and it's going to go over.
I recall, I mean, you've just reminded me of a conversation I had a few years ago, I'd say around 4 or 5 years ago, with, trying not to give out a name, but someone who was a political advisor, senior political advisor here in the UK. And I remember having a discussion. It was a private discussion. It was, you know, in a cafe. And he said something quite remarkable. When I was, you know, telling him about all these things, he said, you know, that, you know, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. But for me to admit what you're saying, it means I need to fault 2-3 generations back. I need to put them at fault. And that's something that no one can do.
Exactly. Thank you.
And probably that is what the younger generation don't care about.
Exactly. Doing. They don't care because they look at us. I'm a little older than you. There's a wonderful, in the National Portrait Gallery, there's a couple of wonderful paintings of military leaders, naval military leaders in about 1920. Mm-hmm. And you look at them now and you think, you fools, mm-hmm. you had no idea. And people who they pretended to lead knew that they had no idea. And that's where we are. It's remarkable that I've had similar conversations with political advisors. Of course, they know exactly what's going on. They're briefed. They know how many. They know when. They know the extent. They know the problem. They can't say it or they will be out of a job. And thankfully, as you know, several Americans in that situation, political advisors in the U.S. State Department have said, well, I'm out of a job. That's it. I'm gone. Can't do it anymore.
And we found, and you know, a flurry of them. We've found several walking away from high-flying jobs where they could have carried on being paid handsomely at the end of every month. But, and this is, you know, the next point I want to make is that, you know, those students, those young people who are giving up their, you know, the comforts of their beds and the times they ought to be in libraries studying for their tests and the such, to sit in tests in the atrocious British weather, may I say, for Palestine, essentially, for Gaza, one of the things that they tell me that drives them, and I'm not wishing to embarrass you here, but people like yourself, whom they say they sort of compel us to think that there is good out there in the world. And those people whom we hear from time every now and then resigning their posts, saying that we can't take it anymore. We just simply can't do this anymore. You know, from being advisor to the White House, from being part of senior positions within whatever party or whatever official figure. They continue to tell me that that motivates them, that drives them, that gives them energy and impetus. And to be perfectly honest, from my point of view, and correct me please if you think I'm off tangent here, but Palestine is not about geographical borders anymore. When you talk about Palestine, you're talking about, and this is something I continue to say to those who listen to me, is that it's become an idea. It's become an icon. Freedom, liberation, for revolt against subjugation, against oppression. And therefore, it's something that you find oppressed people around the world sort of attaching themselves to. And therefore, it takes humanity as a whole to also respond in kind and say, listen, our values don't accept what is happening.
Yes.
It sounds quite simple, but it's...
Well, if I may, back to your analogy about the flat earth or the centrality of the sun in the solar system, it invited a backlash. You know, it was well known and discussed among a lot of people before they started burning anybody at the stake and before Galileo went to jail, etc. So we may face that backlash. But I should also say that the whole argument, of course, was not about astronomy. It was about who wields power. And so in that sense, this is not about Palestine or Palestine's borders or who's who, or even who is of whatever faith. This is about how the world is presumed to be run, how we think it should be run, and we're changing our minds. And thank goodness. And those students you talk about in the rain, Vancouver weather is very similar. We have at least two big encampments, one even in my small town. I look at them and I think, God, I'm retired. I don't have to worry about a degree or anything. You folks are out here getting wet, and we take stuff to them, frequently. They're inspiring us. It's a dynamic.
And ultimately speaking, when we're talking about the kind of values that that people want to be governed by, values of true justice, of real peace, when we're talking about human prosperity, when we're talking about and the kind of equality that we want, the equilibrium that we all yearn, for the world to be on, that everyone is equal, everyone has equal rights, everyone has equal opportunities, equal responsibilities. Why is it that we have in our midst what is becoming to be uncovered as what we call an international community or an international situation, which speaks a lot about these values, but practices very, very little? I mean, to the extent, what is now in the news, obviously, is the ICJ and ICC and the such. These are pillars of what should be this international community that we speak of, a world order that we speak of. Yet now, because of the stands that they've taken, because of the South African case, because of bit by bit, we're seeing the patrons, if you wish, the bastions of international law, such as your country, such as mine, such as the United States, all of a sudden, casting doubts on the neutrality, on the validity, on the stance and biases of those institutions, i.e., they're almost starting to wreck that very international community that we're part of.
It's an absurdity I thought I would never see. As a Canadian, I always thought that Canadians were peacekeepers. It turns out that that's not quite true. But here we have a situation where we're fascinated by a former U.S. president who's now dissing the court and telling the court that it doesn't know what it's doing, and he's successful in doing this. Our leaders are doing exactly the same thing with the ICJ, not quite as with much vulgarity or style or panache, but it's exactly the same response. And it's as if we had an idea 60 years ago about international or global human rights and the rights of the individual that just made sense the way that the universe makes sense. And now we're talking about the rules-based order that means nothing at all. And it is so depressing and disappointing.
But it's dangerous also.
It's absolutely dangerous.
I mean, imagine if these were, if this international order, if it was ripped apart by the very hands that sewed it together.
Which is what is happening, of course. It is being ripped apart. It's being ripped apart with everything from immigration law to this genocide. It's astounding. And it is dangerous in the sense that, yes, the reason we got together after the Second War and said, let's not do this anymore, was because we'd invented nuclear weapons. I mean, that's the ultimate threat. And I didn't think I would ever see another one exploded in my lifetime, but I might. I might live just long enough to hear that it happened somewhere, and it's coming.
And only a few years ago, when we had the spectacle of the security guard at one of the concentration camps, I'm not sure whether it was Auschwitz or somewhere else, a 93-year-old who was hauled before the ICC.
Yes.
And convicted as being a war criminal. He was a guard. He wasn't one of the commanders. He wasn't one of the leaders. And that, it sort of inspired people to think, so justice might take a little while, but it happens.
Yes.
And this became a story. And, we were telling of the kind of achievements that were, but it seems that you know, those laws are designed for some, but not everyone. And, you know, if we are to believe some of the statements that were made recently by the likes of the ICC chief prosecutor, that they were told that, listen, these were set up not to prosecute us. They were in order to prosecute the Africans and the Southerners and the such, not ourselves. I mean, in reality, it just staggers me how people are so blasé when it comes to the fact that the ICJ speaks of plausible war crimes being committed, genocide being committed, yet the current world leaders, as intelligent as they may be, continue on that particular path to support Israel, to encourage Israel, to, as though they don't care for themselves, you know, in their latter years, or their children even being, you know, totally their reputation shredded to bits because of their stance in supporting a war crime.
Are you asking me if I can understand it?
Because I can't explain how these people are so, you know, is there something in the back of their minds that when the time is right, we'll just throw them, you know, dispose with them? What is it?
It's more a matter of, you know, when you know you're going to crash, you're on your motorcycle or your boat, and you know you're heading for disaster within seconds, the seconds spread out into a long, long, long mental period of time, and you hang on, you white knuckle it. You just, if we just get through this, it'll be all right. And you know it's not going to be all right, but you don't believe that you're actually going to die politically or physically. I can't understand it in any other way. And I've met Joe Biden. My wife and I lived in Iowa. My work took me there in 2007. We worked on the Democratic campaign, as good Canadians do. We met Joe Biden. We thought he was pretty plausible. He was very good on healthcare, for example. Lovely guy, gave me a big hug. He's very warm and friendly and kind of goofy, like a grandfather who talks too much. And I think back now, what I didn't know about him and what I could never have imagined, he is a deer in the headlights. And I think it's that moment for him, and I think it's even that moment for Justin Trudeau, who shows no sign of, the lawyers within the government have said, look, you're going to be in trouble here. So Canada, for example, has pretended to stop shipping arms and has to some extent. But it's all just backpedaling and protection, and it'll whistle past us. I hope we won't get hit. I hope they do. I really hope they do.
How do you see the, let's say, the near future? Let's not talk about, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 years' time, but let's talk about what's going to happen in the next, I don't know, 5 years. What's going to happen? I mean, the devastation that's been created is immeasurable, because obviously the carnage and the bloodshed is concentrated in Gaza, but the kind of distrust in the international law, in the validity of the values that the West has often spoken of, democracy, freedom, women's rights, all of this seems to have gone out of the window. So you have this sort of state of fluidity in which the world lives in. I mean, I travel a lot, and wherever I go, this is something common that comes up, regardless of the politics. But people say, okay, who do we trust anymore? Who do we believe in anymore? What do we believe in anymore? So, and I met with one of the Southeast Asian countries recently, and one of the officials in the Foreign Office said, listen, we're being challenged. We have been challenged now for over 30 years over our record of human rights. And he says, whilst I'm more than willing to accept that we have problems and we've been trying hard to, you know, to address these issues, and like, but now all of a sudden everyone's turning around and saying, hang on, are we just wasting our times? Because it seems that human rights doesn't really mean much. So imagine that state of distrust, lack of confidence, lack of belief, And all of a sudden, you know, if Israel can get away with it, why can't others? So how do you see the next, you know, 3 to 5 years?
So is this the part of the interview where I have to be hopeful so that people won't go off and look for a razor blade? I know a lot, and I know so little about geopolitics. I know it as a spectator and a reader. I will say one thing that I hope will be optimistic, and that is that doing the stuff that I do as an activist is kind of fun. Sometimes I hate to admit that, but, you know, we're driving a boat, we're fixing engines, we're traveling around, it's fun. And I know that people who have the time to become personally involved, and this is where it starts and maybe where it ends. When you become personally involved and you meet Palestinians and you meet little kids and you find wonderful people who you would never have expected to even pay attention to in your regular non-activist life, it's engaging. It's good for you. It's good for your mental health. It gets you away from the hourly check on the news that is so damaging to us mentally. Do that, please. If you're listening to this podcast or watching us, find the local thing, even if it's not exactly Palestine, find the local thing that you become obliged to every week, that you go to the meetings, that you raise a bit of money, whatever you do. It's fun. It's liberating. It's liberating to be physically engaged, face to face with people you know, and you learn to trust, and some people you learn not to trust. We're all here. That's the most hopeful thing I can say. As to Palestine itself, at the moment, I think it's going to be pretty miserable for a lot of people for a lot of time. I think many who are starving now and suffering from disease will die. I'm doing what I can about it. We all are here. But I think it's going to be bad. And I think it will lead to a generation who is a generation of Gazans, particularly, who've learned to arm themselves, learned to fight, as always happens when you try to put 2 million people into a box. We've seen it before a couple times. I'm not optimistic about that in the short term, in the next 5 years.
Okay, let's go back to the ship.
All right.
And by the way, I mean, since you're here in the UK, you must realize that the existential threat against our safety and security are the small boats and dinghies that flood the English Channel and try to make their way over to our shores. I'm sure that you're aware of that. So just be careful, be wary of
that. I'm looking around.
You're on the boat on Hanwala.
Yes.
And I'm sure you know the name and the iconic figure that stands behind Hanwala. How long have you been on the boat now?
My wife went to Istanbul in February. We both went to Italy looking for another boat in March, April. And then I'm back here to Newcastle a couple of weeks ago. It seems like a long time ago. And then to Rotterdam, Bremerhaven, back to Rotterdam. I've done less boat driving than I would like to do. That's my place, a little bridge and a steering wheel. In fact, we have a little joystick these days that you twiddle back and forth. It's not quite as nostalgic as I'd like it to be. Hanwala is painted on our boat. Yeah. He's there. When I look down from the bridge, I see him. And I hope he's going to turn around and smile at me someday. Not yet. Did I answer your question? I'm not sure I did.
How many people have been and off the boat?
Oh, this particular boat, by this time, having started in Oslo, it's probably up around 30, 35, 36 people.
What are you trying to achieve?
Well, they all have slightly different views, but I'll tell you, having done a couple of these trips, yes, it's important to get near Gaza and be picked up and make it a pain in the neck for the Israelis and for your national representatives there who have to deal with the legalities and find an airport. That's good. That's all good. It keeps it in the news. The most valuable part of this is the conversations along the way and meeting people. And we meet supporters, of course, who are there. They wave at us. They love us. They bring us food. They help us find parts for the engine, and they run off to buy stuff for us and do errands, and they're very, very happy to do that. And it's delightful to see them engage that way. We also meet the skeptics, and we have these little conversations like you've had, more and more informed than they were, a little more sympathetic, still quite confused. Confused, that is, you know, their own values clash. I had a conversation with a very serious Christian the other day, a barge captain. You know, it made no sense to me, but I left him, I hope, with a little bit of a conundrum. Maybe he'll wind that around in his head, and maybe someday it'll mean something to him. It's those conversations that are important. And so the value of these trips is not just poking our nose toward Gaza in the Eastern Mediterranean, although that's significant. It is all of these conversations, as I'm having with you, along the way. I was really looking forward to getting that little boat under the Tower Bridge and giving the finger to Westminster. I have a friend who would love to see a little boat go up the Potomac and park right in front of the Lincoln Memorial with Palestinian flags. I hope we can do that. But that's what's important. It's these are the nodes of power, London, Washington, etc. It's these people who we have to give permission to. It's those politicians who know what's going on, but they don't have permission yet to say it because they're worried it's going to lose them a couple of votes here and there with those folks and these folks. We have to give them the permission to be leaders.
What happened in the French Parliament with one MP raising the Palestinian flag and being dismissed and then going out and joining a pro-Palestine demonstration. I encountered several people on my social media pages asking, well, what was the point? And I think that your answer answers that question, particularly because, you know, sometimes when we're talking about resistance, we imagine in our minds, you know, the grand, you know, rise of, you know, the final scene of Les Misérables and the French Revolution and the such. But in order to get to that moment, it's a small act of defiance.
Absolutely.
It's those sort of, as you put it, those nudges, those pricks, those provocations to the system. Those points of annoyance.
Yes, annoyance, yes.
Annoyance, yeah.
Going out to buy your bowl of bread in Paris in 1790, whatever, and finding, oh, cripe, it's another sou. Yeah. Those bastards. And we're at that point now. We can hear that in the street where people complain about the economy.
And it's the collective. I mean, imagine if we all engaged in those small acts that might in isolation mean very little, but as a collective, they point to a human race rising in defiance. And you know, when often, I mean, one of the common questions that come my way whenever I'm talking is the fact that people understand that I hail from Iraq, and they ask me about, okay, fine, what about the Arab and Muslim nations, and why aren't they doing anything? And once again, sometimes we're expecting that, you know, avalanche of human, but we negate to look at the importance of those small acts. And I give, for example, something that I'm also involved in and can actually see the impact of, and that is the boycott, divestment, sanctions program, and the kind of impact that's happening in real terms, you know, when the Starbucks CEO stands and shows how share prices have plummeted, for instance, and when McDonald's goes and buys every single branch of the Israeli franchise, and when you realize that those small acts, you know, those questions many months ago, oh, come on, it's just a can of Coke, I mean, what's going to happen? But this is what's going to happen.
Yes.
And I was fortunate enough. My political awakening was when I was about 16, 17, and as a young student in Manchester, when I saw a bunch of people standing outside my college raising banners talking about the ANC and someone called Nelson Mandela and about something called apartheid, which I had never, ever heard of before. I didn't even know how to pronounce. And I had to go and do the research, and I became part of that movement. And we know, and through the wordings and the memoirs of people like Desmond Tutu, like Nelson Mandela, how that movement was instrumental in bringing down a system which was supported by the powers of the time, by Margaret Thatcher here in London, by Ronald Reagan, by, you know.
So Mandela was still a terrorist.
And he was still a terrorist. And Margaret Thatcher famously said that he would never, ever walk the streets of London. And I know, and I saw how the Conservative Party members would give out flyers, those small postcards, calling for the hanging of Nelson Mandela and his comrades who were fighting apartheid.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Absolutely. So I mean, we're talking again about this collective revolution that starts with the very simple seed of awareness, of understanding. And I go back to that. And this is something that I'm definitely seeing.
Well, I'll say two things about that. I've been close enough to corporate people in charge of revenue and marketing and where are sales at this week and this month to know that it takes a tiny tick down in sales that's inexplicable by season or whatever. It's politics, my goodness. That keeps people up at night, and boy, they change their minds quickly. So that economic pulling the rug out from under is enormously effective. By the way, there's a wonderful cola drink called Palestine Cola, which I believe is available here in the UK. I hope it's available in Canada. And if it's not, I'm going to do something about that. But also I want to say that there's a kind of a game I play sometimes. I'll be walking the streets of London or whatever on the way here, and I'll look at all the people I can see on that street or in the tube or wherever, and I think, how many of these people actually support Palestine? And I know that I could count more than a dozen at most times, but we don't mention it to each other. We don't talk about it. We pass each other in the dark like ships in the night, I suppose, without bringing it up. And now we all, it is a genocide. The ICJ has said, yes, we're pretty sure it's going that way. We all have permission to say, damn it, we can talk about this now. And that's when it starts to change. That's when that famous network effect, you know, begins with 2 and then 4 and 16 and whatever. That's when it changes. And that's where we're at now.
You know, a few weeks back, I was with my little girls, and we were on the tube on the underground, and my youngest pointed to me at one stage. You know how people are just sitting there, just looking at their mobile phones, no one's paying attention. But the little ones, because they don't have mobile phones, they look around, they look at people, they look in their faces. We stopped doing that at a certain time of our age. And she nudged me and she said, Baba, have you noticed how many people are wearing the Palestinian kufiya? And I looked around and I could swear there was more than half of the carriage.
Really?
That had
That's
somehow,
wonderful.
You know, either their t-shirts or some band wrist or the kufiya around their necks or on their heads.
Yeah.
And without saying anything, without speaking to each other.
Right.
That was there. That was it.
Now, this is embarrassing. You remind me that I left mine in my bag outside the studio. It's there, I promise. But yes, yeah. To walk around Vancouver and see somebody riding a bicycle, sipping by with it. That was a kefir. My goodness.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
I mean, it's become the fashion status of today. And that in itself is something which we mustn't neglect. I mean, this is... if you wish, I mean, we sometimes jump to use certain terms such as movement or the such, but what we're seeing is something quite extraordinary. I don't know if, you know, I was one of the leaders of the 2 million march in Iraq, against the war in Iraq in February 2003.
Thank you for that.
I was one of the organizers of that global day, the 15th of February 2003. 40 million people around the world, from all the way from the Solomon Islands eastwards to Chile westwards, around 24 hours a day marched for Iraq. And I can definitely say this is different. This feels different. This has reached corners of society which we never thought. And by the way, I mean, I always bang on about this, that probably the most significant element within this movement is the Jewish bloc, is the anti-Zionist bloc. I mean, this is what is actually probably the backbone of this movement. And this is in a way what is sustaining, you know, this and keeping it going. Because, and we have here in London, we have, you know, a group whom we see every single time, unfailingly, come rain or sunshine. The elder Holocaust surviving, children of Holocaust survivors or Holocaust victims, who were there standing, you know, not in our name, you know, raising the Palestinian flag, raising the pictures of slain Palestinian children. It is those that are inspiring people.
I have sometimes said during a demonstration, I've never been among more Jews than I am here at this demo. And I'll tell you a very quick story about a lovely woman who's long gone now, but she, a little older than me, she studied archaeology. And as a Jew, she decided to go off and do Aliyah and go to Israel. And she came back 7 years later, absolutely disgusted. She was a real comedian. She told a story about being an archaeologist in her university and how they'd go out and do field work. She'd supervise young students doing field work, and how the field work was, Assyrian, into the bin. Jewish. I've found a piece. Brush it off. Mark it. Register it. And she would carry this on, you know, hilariously. It was very hard for her to come back to Canada and admit to her family, to her mom, a Holocaust survivor, no, it's not working over there. It's going wrong. And this was many years ago. This was, she's long gone. It's very hard for dissident Jews to face this political reality and come to terms with this for themselves in a family that, you know, is quite often very seriously pro-Zionist, even now. They deserve so much credit. And at the same time, they find that they have to be careful to share that stage with their Palestinians. You can't dominate it, even though you have this very, very powerful message to people like me. Because, of course, it's Jews who give people like me permission to talk about this.
Are you still hopeful that one day you break the siege on Gaza? You yourself, you'll see that shoreline, you'll tread on the sandy beaches of Gaza?
Even if I wash up in the surf in a kayak with a broomstick flagpole and a Palestinian flag on it, and, you know, stagger up onto the beach, yes, I want to do that.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.